Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
A very good morning to everyone and welcome to this week installment of Beyond Governance here at 101.9 High FM. My name is Nimrod Tembele. It is always a pleasure to share this space and time with you, the beloved listener of this wonderful show, as we stretch our minds for better and deeper understanding of some of the complexities around governance issues. Anyway, before we get into the gist of our conversation, allow me to dispense with basic formalities with sincerity, though. Thanks to Howard Farman, who's doing the morning mayhem, and he's doing a sterling work. He'll be back on your radio tomorrow. In the meantime, I also want to thank Vusima Singh, Craig Guthrie, who are the technical producers of the show. Last but not least, Daniel Kastner, who is the producer of this particular show. Moving along, if you missed any of our previous conversation, not to despair, simply go to the website, download any of the podcasts of your favorite. Of course, your views are welcome via my X handle, which is _@DrMbele. In today's episode, we're putting a spotlight on the government of national unity. I'm sure this is a topic that will linger for some time, given its complexities. We know that the ANC or none of the political parties were able to garner more than 50% votes to have their own cabinet without having to consult. So coalitions has become a norm, or will become a norm, in a political space where none of the parties are able to garner more than 50%. In making sense of this very interesting topic, I'm joined by Alan Mokoki, who is the CEO at the South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry, known as SACCI. And we really want to know what are some of the implied or explicit ramifications of the government of national unity from the perspective of SACCI. Without any wasting of time, Alan, thank you very much for gracing Beyond Governance with your presence.
Good morning, Nimrod, and good morning to your listeners as well.
Thank you very much. We now have 10 political parties which form the government of national unity. Your overall observation as SACCI on this issue?
Well, I think that the first thing is that quite clearly there was no outright winner in respect of someone who can get a complete majority at the national polls. And some have interpreted, people give things a lot of interpretations, and sometimes it's not clear why they get to the interpretation that they get to. I've heard that the very same political parties that the voters actually gave them a mandate from a GNU. I'm not so sure where that statement comes from. I haven't met a single voter, by the way, who went into the polls to create or with an idea that they want to do a GNU or to mandate a GNU. I think that people themselves were committed to voting for those that they were voting for. But there is a missing link in terms of something that we're not dealing with as it relates to the meaning of the loss of a majority vote. Because you will recall, Nimrod, that there were 27.7 million people who were actually registered to vote and qualified to vote. And yet 11.7 million did not actually show up. And I think that that's where the story ought to start, to find out who these people are. Why didn't they actually participate? Was there an issue around access? And it's highly unlikely. Was there an issue around intimidation? It's highly unlikely as well. So quite clearly, there is an element of disillusionment from. So what you then see, in a sense, is not so much that the one organization loses votes to another organization. What you really are seeing is a situation. Yes, of course, there's an element of MKP as a party that just showed up from nowhere very quickly, but they themselves are taking votes from everyone, as a matter of fact. But there is an outstanding silent voter bloc, that is really huge, because if you're saying, 11.7 million people didn't actually vote, that's a very big number, and we need to really be able to understand that. But coming back to the GNU, of course, those who got elected needed to find a way to form some kind of a government or take the option of going back and having another poll. And all those particular moves do, by their very nature, cause instability. Whether you're going to have a new election, it was going to cause anxiety and people not knowing what the outcome might well be. But at the same time, when you're putting together a GNU of political parties who all share very different political philosophies, political policies, political platforms, that in itself is good in terms of saying you have a GNU, but it only becomes stable when there's agreement on what those policy positions are actually going to be. Right now, there's a lot of uncertainty because we don't necessarily know where the GNU will actually go. It's highly unlikely. Some people, and you've seen the various letters being exchanged, some people assuming that just because they're in government, they are going there in the executive, they are going there to pursue the policies of their own party, but that's not going to work. So in the end, you end up in a situation where you need to have the policies of the government of national unity, because that is what is now going to take place. Are they going to review the policy? Which are the policies on which they actually agree? Which do they not agree with? And I think that I'm listening to most of the leaders of these political parties who are actually in the GNU. It looks like we're in for a torrid time over the next 6 to 12 months.
Thank you very much for that observation. And we're going to take a break. We'll be back in a second, because you've raised a number of pertinent points that I want you to probe a little bit further. Let's take a break. We'll be back in a second.
Did you know that where markets are concerned, it's not easy to detect the difference between objective and subjective reality, or between reality and fantasy? The business's view of the consumer has serious bottom-line implications. At Plus 94 Research, we help businesses cut through the uncertainty by gathering and processing real consumer intelligence through advanced scientific research methodologies. Plus 94 Research, the science of decision-making.
Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. I am joined by Ellen Mukoki, who is the CEO at the South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry, known as SACI. We are probing the ramification of the government of national unity. I suppose everyone knows that we have about 10 political parties that have formed the GNU. And there are a number of interesting points that Ellen pointed out before we took that short break. The one I want to start with, Ellen, 11.7 million of South Africans who are pretty much disillusioned or frustrated because they don't see any value in the current political system. That's a huge number. What would you say, from business point of view, is the mischief? Because it can't be that a half of the population are just simply not interested. There has to be something different that a business can do or ought to do to try to activate those, because there lies a huge opportunity. There lies huge opportunity for growth, huge opportunity for economic stability. Your take on that point?
Sorry, Nimrod, I think you got, I lost you there for a moment. So if you can repeat the question, if you don't mind.
I've said to you, you raised a very pertinent point that there are about 11.7 million South Africans who do not show up at the polling station because they're simply disillusioned. And the question is, what is the mischief? Because this pattern seems to be growing and there has to be something that is done. I'm not sure clearly government has not done enough or failed. What would be the different approach from business to try and activate this 11.7 million voters who are just simply not interested?
I think that, as you know, your right to participate in the politics of the country includes the right not, you know, in other words, so the democracy by its very nature simply allows you choice, and that choice of choosing whatever political party that you'd like to run the affairs of the country includes also the election not to participate. So we don't know, and I think that we do require science to be able to guide us. When I say disillusionment, it's speculation, because quite clearly, you don't have all the other elements that can stop people from coming. You know, you don't have the elements that can stop access. There were queues, there were enough polling booths. We didn't hear cases of political intimidation or people being threatened that they shouldn't necessarily vote. None of those elements have been recorded as evidence. So the only one that we can default to is that people are just apathetic. And I think that the people are apathetic because they haven't seen much action from a delivery point of view in terms of what the relevance of government is, or they have not been motivated sufficiently enough to be encouraged to understand their civic duty in electing, or they just believe it doesn't matter. In the end, whether we vote or we don't vote, we don't really see much of a difference. Or, you know what, we're unhappy with the one that we want to vote for, but we're even equally more unhappy with the ones that are available, and maybe people lack choice in terms of if we don't go with A because A is making us unhappy or irritated with A, B, C, D, and E are also not choices. So let me rather sit at home and do nothing. But generally, I'm saying that because we've seen that in places like Zimbabwe. The more people were unhappy with the incumbent government, they didn't want to vote someone else. You started having things like, you know, people, 30% of people showing up in voting in elections. And that in itself is not a very good sign. So a lot of education, a lot of engagement, a lot of different ways of communicating with people, and maybe even a different way of allowing people to vote, because you do need to get digital at some stage. You know, you can't be having people joining very long queues all the time. The issue of trust. And we give a lot of confidence in any of the digital platforms that we can use to do the voting. We can probably get to that particular point, yes.
Interesting observation indeed. The other point that you raised that I want us to follow up on is that of a pokey course of ideologies, which makes it difficult for any policy to be implemented. One of the issues that you raised, that there's this inherent assumption that political parties that are part of the GNU would pursue their own policies, which is also difficult. But from a business point of view, what would you say is the position of business in relation to this kind of state? Because it does not inspire confidence.
No, it can't. It certainly it doesn't inspire confidence, purely because you know, politicians can come together to achieve a particular outcome that may not necessarily have anything to do with the interests of the republic, so to speak. Like, okay, you get together because you want to form a government, but can you make that particular government work? The principles that they put forward in terms of wanting to have evidence-based policies and all those things are very good things in an environment where it's simpler. Right now, the two major parties are struggling with interpretations of meaning. You know, number one, it's not particularly even clear when they continue to say our ministers, that they're not talking about the ministers of the same GNU. It's like the ministers of our political party have got to implement a policy. And you're not hearing, are you actually suggesting that the ministers of your particular party will implement the policies of your own party? Whether you are the ANC, are you saying that your ministers must implement ANC policy? But ANC policy needs to be debated and agreed to by, say, the DA or the IFP or the PA. Has that agreement on policy part happened? And it hasn't happened. And then you hear things like, oh, yeah, but we've got clause 19 and clause whatever of the agreement itself. And it talks about sufficient consensus. And then you ask, what is sufficient consensus? And they say 60%. And the two major political parties also have a very different interpretation of what they mean by 60% of sufficient consensus. The DA seems to have an idea that says 60% of NA seats in the GNU. In other words, those parties that have got 60% NA seats but happen to be the GNU can reach sufficient consensus, whatever the case that means. And the ANC on the other side seem to have a very different interpretation that, wait a minute, you come to the GNU with the number of seats, and then inside the GNU, we now have X number of seats. Let's say, originally, if you have the ANC with 159 and the DA with 87 and the IFP with 19 or whatever the number be, the PA with 9, those seats, when they are in the GNU, they're only 273 seats. Then it's 60% of that 273. That creates a very different permutation altogether, because 60% of 400 in the NA and 60% in the GNU, when you say 273 seats, are two different numbers completely. So you end up in a different interpretation, because in that interpretation, you would then end up in a situation where the ANC and the PA alone can actually reach sufficient consensus, and they don't necessarily need the DA to agree. If you do that other calculation, if you do another calculation, it basically means only a 60% can only be reached if the DA and the ANC agree, which means you always will need the DA to agree before you go for. So you understand that pochikos in itself, in terms of how you're going to take an agreement, creates a serious problem. So the political parties need to get to the ground floor on that immediately, so that they have a very clear understanding of what that sufficient consensus means. And I think that it's possible as well, and I'm not saying, I'm speculating, it's possible that the ambiguity is deliberate, in that if it's ambiguous, the more ambiguous it is, the more fluid it should be. And when it's fluid, you can't really hold me to your interpretation, and neither can I hold you to my interpretation. So we will just continue to do this thing that we're actually going to do. So I think that the in lies the possibility of an instability. But there is also a good element in it as well, in that at least what the major party has done, the biggest of the parties, is to collect all the other smaller parties into the GNU, which then necessarily would indicate that if they all were inside, the possibility of collapsing that government is much more smaller were there to be a major area of dispute between the ANC and the DA. But what that means, nobody really knows. So yes, there is a lot of uncertainty, a lot of anxiety around whether the parties themselves have similar interpretations and meanings of the very agreement that they have actually signed. And what would it then mean, starting with the point that I made, that you've got political parties that are clearly, let's go into the area of, for instance, one of the triggers, triple PE policy, you know.
Absolutely.
Land expropriation without compensation.
You read my mind, yeah, because that was my natural, I was gravitating towards the very same point, because we know we've got the land issue, we've got a national health insurance, we've got the foreign policy in relation to the Middle East, and we've got issues around foreign direct investments. These are big ticket items, which if not carefully navigated through, if there's not enough consensus, would undermine the investment that is so desperately needed. Let's take a break in a second.
Did you know that most statistics for commercial and social research are tested for accuracy at a 95% confidence level? As specialists in the field, we do tests between 90 and 99% confidence levels. This is not to be confused with our name. Plus 94 is a celebration of the miracle post 94 in South Africa. We can still test the accuracy of your data at 94%. It is in our name to give you the confidence you need. Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. My name is Nimrod. I am joined by Ellen Mokoki, who is the executive at the South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Debunking the ramification of the Government of National Unity, which is a very interesting environment we find ourselves in at the moment as South Africans. Before into the break, I mean, Ellen was giving us his sense around the controversies, or would be controversies, on how different ideological disposition, different stance on different standards on issues such as the BEE, the land issue, the national health insurance, foreign policy. And these obviously are big ticket items which consensus is required to move with speed. And now that we have this potential quagmire, it is very much unlikely that the foreign investment that we need, the job creation that is desperately needed, can be unlocked. So under these circumstances, you as business sit on the table with government. Back then, you'd have a chair or you'd sit around a table with the ANC government. How would you influence the policy, or how would you sensitize the Government of National Unity, as from the time you'd be invited, to have a conversation on what are the inherent risks of the current environment, and an extent to which dealt with, subject to clarity on specific policies? Your take or your approach on how the role of business, because there's no doubt in my mind, there's no doubt in the minds of South Africans, that in the past, business voice was not as articulate as ought to be. Business voice was not as strong as ought to be. Perhaps maybe the GNU provide that kind of space where business voice would be slightly stronger, because you don't have, none of the political parties have monopoly. And we understand the ramifications of the political space that we find ourselves. Unemployment rate is the highest, crime is the highest, and the economy is not doing well. So just what are those nuggets, or what are those specific issues which present an opportunity for business to rally around and make a difference this time around?
I think that there are many opportunities, Nimrod, and one of the things that we need to deal with even on the business side is that you shouldn't necessarily have minority voices within business aiming to represent business, and that does not make any sense, because we've tried to put together a big unity, say, within the big larger federation, but it's a struggle to unite business, basically. You know, you still have elements where the Black Business Council is still outside of the BUSA fold. And BUSA itself has not necessarily shown growth or a willingness to be really the united voice of business. You've got elements maybe within the BLSA who come out to speak from time to time. There are many, as we are raising the same issue with voters staying outside of active politics and not participating in the vote, you see exactly the same element with business, where many, many businesses are not actually in organized business. They're actually outside of organized business. So the first thing is that we do need to have a restructure of the very voice of business in itself, so that business itself speaks with one voice, not individuals speaking on behalf of business and claiming that they are representing a business. So we as business, we need a business of national unity so that we can look at ourselves as we move towards a national dialogue to say, these people who keep saying they're representing business, who exactly are they representing? Because you can't say a Busa would represent business when they only have less than, say, 30 national businesses, you know, corporates. And there are almost more than 500 businesses that are actually listed on the JSE, and the majority of them are not in any of those structures, you know. So we need to sort that one out. And then the second thing, of course, is that that's what I'm saying, the invite that goes to business must be broad and intensive. Stop inviting the usual people because you assume that they are the only people who represent business when in fact they're not. So invite everybody, make it an open invitation. So invite each and every business formation that exists in South Africa, including those that may not actually be in any organized formation. Because the problem with some of the formations is that they expect you to pay before you become a member. So if you're not paying, you're not going to be a member. But why must you pay to participate in democracy in South Africa? It doesn't make no sense. So we need to fix that part. But then we do need to then say, now that we've got a voice or a common voice, we can all speak with confidence that we're speaking for people who are actually existing and they're in the majority. We then need to sit down with government in the national dialogue and deal with the issues that we need to deal with. And one of those issues that we're actually raising was, how do you build a capable state? And let's have a common definition of that, because you can't just continue to use words and say capable state. And we must have a similar agenda as well, because you see, that's what Nimrod, when we spoke earlier on around the issue relating to transformation, in that our template should be the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. We've said that even on this show, I've said it before. For South Africa to resolve its big challenges of unemployment, inequality, of poverty, South Africa needs to move from being a developing economy into becoming a developed economy. And only probably about 8 non-Western countries have managed to achieve that feat in the last 100 years. And you count amongst those Japan, you know, Taiwan, South Korea, Singapore, old Hong Kong, you know, Russia, Israel, and Australia. No one else coming out of non-West has actually managed to do that. And why are these SDGs important? Because they are the determinant of whether you are now a developed economy, because they deal with the issues of no poverty, zero hunger, right? And I'm coming to these transformation pieces because they happen to be in the same sustainable development goals as they are defined. These are the things that are going to make you achieve things in a way that's sustainable. Then they go into this piece around good health and well-being. South Africa may come back and say, we want to form an HAI around that. The principle itself is not a problem. The implementation then becomes a problem. But then we need to work together ourselves. We can't just be rejecting everything all the time and never coming up with a solution, because the real objective is not an HAI. An HAI is supposed to be a facilitator. The real objective is universal access to quality healthcare. How can we do that as society, as South Africa? It doesn't matter whether the ANC calls it NHI, or Obama calls it Obamacare, or somebody else calls it whatever, or the British call it, you know, whatever they call it. What is this that we want to see happen? Do we even agree, by the way, that when you and me, we've got medical aid, the auntie who works in our house must also have access? Do we agree? Because if we don't agree that, we're going to keep fighting with each other, because you and me, we want to hoard all the medical and health resources for me and you and my kids because we can afford it. But the people, who looks after our homes, and the person who's a gardener and the security guard, they don't actually have access. So that's a very intense discussion that must actually take place. Because why? If we don't fix the issue of health, and this issue of health, by the way, does not only feature under the United Nations Sustainable Goals, it also features under the World Economic Forum when we talk about the 12 pillars that make a country competitive. In other words, the Global Competitive Index report has got the issue of health as one of the key variables that enables you to be competitive. So we ought not to be ambiguous when it comes to what we mean by this issue of health. The issue of quality education, for instance, it's also in the UN SDGs. Is it correct that for you to get for you to get access to high quality education, you need to have money? Why must we do that? So only the thing to go to the private education providers, the Saint Somethings or the Curos of this world, will get the high quality. Those who remain behind in the under-resourced government schools are not. So we need to have this national dialogue to say, how are we going to create universal access so that the standard of a big school like is exactly the same as the standard at Orlando West High in Vilakazi Street in Soweto. And the quality of the teacher is also the same, because that's a big, do these partners in the GNU even understand that to be the same? Or everyone else is fighting for the to preserve their own little cocoon and their own thing that is giving them the advantage at this particular point in time. So that's what we as a business would then say, these are the things. Because when you do that, then our businesses are going to grow in a way that is what? The key word is sustainable. It's going to grow sustainably. We're not trying to survive. Yeah. Economic growth for today.
But here's the thing, Alan, I mean, you have hit it on a nail by not painting a rosy picture around the unity of business. Business is very, definitely heterogeneous. It's very diverse, and they're very, you know, interest in that. But I suppose the bigger question is, I mean, you've really highlighted a number of points that even your biggest union within business environment don't necessarily represent everybody. And there are individuals within certain formation who claim to be represent the voices of the business. So clearly, that's something that business needs to sort out, because business will not, I don't see an environment where government can take you serious when business itself is divided. And I do like the point that there has to be inclusive business formation that can have a very similar approach on issues around sustainable goals, issues around what actually it means for South Africa to become to move from a developing to developed state. So what role business should be playing in driving South Africa transition from a developing to developed state? The point that they've raised about the UN sustainable goals are obviously important. And principally, most people that I've spoken to, they don't disagree, for an example, on the national health insurance that everybody should have access to quality health care. But again, I mean, I did not speak to every South African. I spoke to a few medical aid bosses and so on and so forth. There are specific issues, obviously, which they are worried about. When you look at education, the dissent voice in the main is around the power of the union, because the assumption is that the unions in South Africa are way too powerful and are literally running the show. And that is why the quality of education is not at the level where it's supposed to be. So these are some of the issues that are obviously very complex, because when you look at education, for example, you can't have a teacher who is under-resourced, teacher who's sitting in front of 80 kids with varying levels of cognitive capabilities to comprehend. So that teacher has to mark 80 script, has to complete the curricula. So that teacher is likely to focus on a cohort of students that are likely to get to the next level. So these are some of the complex issues that can only take us forward, provided there's a clearer thought processes between business and government and how to take this issue forward. So coming back to business, because fundamentally, I've always argued that business voice is not strong enough. And based on what you have put to us, there are pockets of huge opportunities, frankly speaking, that the government of national unity is more likely to concede to some of your thought processes in terms of how to take the economy out of the quagmire as it should be. So perhaps maybe the dialogue that you are proposing as business could be a starting point. But what would you say is the appetite for business? Because we can't claim a government is not as united, whereas a business is in a similar space in terms of their own bottom line requirements.
Yes, I mean, you know, we talk in South Africa in the context most likely where we You know, they always say that the biggest weakness all of us can ever have as individuals is the lack of self-awareness. You know, South Africa is a very complex environment. It's a very complex environment with some of the most biggest challenges that anyone can ever face in leadership, as well as in global politics. And one of the elements that we've tended to misunderstand is in the narrative, where even us as people who are in business, there's an assumption that people in business know. That is not actually true. I've met a lot of my own colleagues in business leadership who are ignorant about what's going on in South Africa and the very same solutions. The difference is that they lack the awareness that they don't actually know themselves and that they don't have the level of leadership that's required to deal with the big issues and the complex issues that are facing South Africa. And that's a fact. You can't avoid it. And part of it has a lot to do with the fact that we are not developing our own business leaders. We only want to teach them the ratio, how to calculate a financial ratio, how to mix a chemical, you know, how to dig up resources from the ground, and how to run a processing plant or a smelter, how to design an electric system and build a car because they are engineers and calculate the risk on an insurance product because they're actuaries. But we're not necessarily teaching them leadership skills in terms of how to look at society in its totality. So quite a number of our own business leaders, they come into many of these engagements, including at NetLec, to only talk about their own interests in terms of protecting the their own businesses. But they're not as interested, if you think about it, to solve the big problems that South Africa is facing. They are not sitting there worrying about some kid in Deep Slot who actually woke up very hungry and does not have school uniform and has got to travel a distance walking to school, and that particular environment is anti-growth and development in its own. You're not going to find too many business leaders who think at that particular level. They disengage when it comes to that particular debate, and they then leave it to government, and then they end up just criticizing government without making a serious contribution. So the idea of development, training and development in leadership, in businesses itself, in business leadership, is very, very critical. Because if we miss that part, because there are many business leaders, by the way, you've heard me speak about the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, and many of the transformational pieces happen to be in that. Because we talk about gender equality as item number 5 in the UN Sustainable Development Goals. In other words, your society will not develop if you leave women behind. How many business leaders do you know who think that gender equality is important? No, they don't think that. A huge number of my colleagues who also happen to be in business would be thinking, well, you know, the government is bothering them. In fact, they'll even go out to make statements such as, but investors will not come to South Africa because there are requirements for transformation. There are requirements to get women into business, women into skills and competences, women so that they can have rising income, so that they can fuel the economy. But your South African business leader will tell you, but actually that is going to cause foreign investors not to come into the country. You understand what I'm saying around narrative? Around the lack of leadership development, that even the people in business who've got a very loud voice, they don't even understand these kinds of issues relating to, but you're never going to be a developed economy if you leave people behind, if you're not as inclusive. And they want to define inclusive in their own image, what they mean by inclusivity. We can have a few women coming in to join us. That's inclusivity to them. But that is not actually true, because that's going to make us succeed in any way as a country. So you then need to teach and develop leaders. Our business schools need to develop our leaders. Our organizations need to design programs that teach our own business leaders how to operate in multicultural and diverse environments. And that's why many of them, when they move their businesses abroad, they don't actually succeed, because our own South African businesses struggle to operate in an environment which is culturally diverse, or especially in environments where people don't speak English.
Hold on to that thought, because I think you're coming down with, you know, coming out with gun blazing, very interesting thought processes, diagnosing your own particular environment and business. Let's take a break. We'll be back in a second.
We've weathered the unexpected. We've stepped into a new world. And now it is the time for our businesses to re-emerge. Sure-footed, clear-headed, and strategically on point.
It is a time for greater certainty, for accurate, actionable market research and business intelligence to make effective, up-to-date decisions. South Africa, that is how we move our businesses and economy forward. Plus 94 Research, the science of decision-making.
Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision-making.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. My name is Nimrod Bele. I'm joined by Ellen Mokoko, who is an executive at the South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry, known as SACI. We are talking the ramifications of the government of national unity. We are at the point where I put to him the role of business, because business, over the past 30 years or so, the voice of the business has not been as solid enough. The voice of business has not been consistent enough, because business sits with government, business advise government, and yet we have not really seen much shift in terms of the policies and in terms of how business, how government operate. Would not be talking, Eskom would not be where it is if we have had competent executive. All the SOE, in fact, would not be where they are if business voice was not stronger and not pushy. But obviously, we understand how complex this this environment is. And I then said, you know, because of the government of national unity, business has a greater opportunity to exploit, because there are a lot of voices that could give it audience. So this is not an opportunity which business must never miss. In as much as government of national unity is a very shaky one, there are a lot of political differences, there are ideological differences, there are priority differences. There's just so many differences. But as where business sits, there are a lot of opportunities that business can actually do. I like the point that you put, and then around the level of ignorance among your peers, because obviously people have just been taught to do exactly. If you want to become a strategist, you just do strategy. You want to do you want to balance the book, you can balance the books. You want to dig the hole and instead fiber, you can do that. But there's bigger developmental ethos that every single business person should actually know. But here's the thing, businesses, look, we've got corporate social investments, you know, that's not my problem. I've paid my taxes. A company, we've got social corporate government, a social investment. So that's where we have done our bit. You know, we're not there, we're not government, we're not there to solve government's problem. We wouldn't give a hoot about the child that is walking from this flute to school without, because we have made our own contribution through the corporate social investments initiatives. We've built schools and so on and so forth. So that is a typical response that you get from any business. And I also like the idea that business do not understand the level of ignorance in some instances around gender equality, because if you empower a woman, you empower community. And at that philosophical and practical level, you know, the more women you have in upper echelons of businesses, the better. I mean, business has done fine. When you compare the stats of senior managers in government, majority of them are women. In fact, they are close to 49, 50, which is the highest in this country. But in business, the same is not the case, which also partly answers your question about ignorance. And I might even say resistance, because it can't be when you look at some of the employment equity reports, year in, year out, the ratios don't simply make a difference.
Yes, I think that because we're not necessarily, because for the longest time, when I say leadership development, is that many people in business would see the era of transformation as a garage buy. You know, we always say people don't wash a rented car. So as long as you treat it as a rented car, you know, it belongs to any one of the big budget rented car, Avis or Imperial, whatever. And you're not necessarily going to wash it, because you don't think that you're committed to it at a personal level yourself. So that creates a problem. But as I'm saying, there are two templates. One is the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. The other And we have our own, the National Development Plan. But I'll leave that aside for now because I want to talk only about these ones that are global, because you hear a lot of noise about investment, foreign investment, what the outside world is looking at. This is how the outside world is going to look at us. How are you doing in line with the UN SDGs? That's what is the template. And secondly, the World Economic Forum says, here are the 12 pillars of how we look at a global competitiveness index. Your country will be competitive when you can deliver on these things. And health is one of them. Size of market, your own market, where you are, is another, right? Labor efficiency is another. Now, if you look at just those pieces and you say, I'm looking at size of market, and I'm looking at health, and I'm looking at education, and I'm looking at labor efficiency, I'm looking at institutions and all those things. How are you going to deliver those things if you're not developing and growing your own market domestically? How are you going to grow that market domestically if 80% of the people of that particular country are outside of the system because they lack skills, they lack opportunities to get into business, because you are opposing all the transformation legislation and policies? Therein lies the problem, right? So we need to be able to understand that if we don't get these women of ours in South Africa skills, competencies, and get them into jobs and into businesses so that they can fuel the economy, it will take us longer to get to the other side. So yes, you're correct. As long as you've got business leaders who think, well, we'll pay the taxes, it means therefore those are the business leaders who are okay technically to run their businesses, but they're not okay from a leadership point of view to be having a big conversation with big government around the policy choices for the republic. That's the point that I'm making. Yet they are the people in the room who want to talk to government about what government should do when they themselves lack the development to understand the complexity of the problem. And not just the complexity of the problem as it relates to South Africa. You know, I spoke earlier on about the eight non-Western countries that have actually moved from developing to developed. You look at South Korea, Singapore, you look at old Hong Kong and places like that. These are the same countries that are investing, that are moving lots of capital deployment into the new ASEAN countries that include Bali, Cambodia, you know, Indonesia, Vietnam, Thailand, and places like that. 650 million people in the ASEAN countries, right? Growing at rates of 5 to 7%. Who's doing the investment there? It's these former Asian tigers that are now developed economies. South Africa cannot develop. South Africa will not grow the economy by ignoring the continent or ignoring the region itself. You talk to a typical South African business leader about what's happening in Uganda, they don't have a clue. What's happening in the DRC, they don't have a clue. Do you understand where I'm headed? There is no way we can sustainably grow the South African economy if we leave our own neighborhood behind, because that's where money is to be made. That's where markets are actually to be built. But if we don't care about the infrastructure in the DRC, we don't care about what's happening in Zambia, we don't care about what's happening in Rwanda, we're crying out loud. I see it there at Saki. We receive delegations and delegations of business people who come from other countries. Are you familiar with any South African delegation program where South African business people, the very leaders that we have, are going out there to go look for opportunities? They're exploring opportunities in other countries. We meet the Chinese here every day. We meet the Singaporeans here every day. We meet the Europeans here every day. But they also complain and say, but when are the South African businesses coming to visit our country? We're at a meeting with the business people from Turkey. And they were telling us here that, you know, we've never had a visit. Would you guys set up a visit? We've never had a visit. So the only time that our businesses are going to go anywhere is when there's a state visit. And President Ramaphosa doesn't visit a lot of places, by the way, so you know. And there's no program that's very clear that, you know, in this year as a president, I'm going to target, you know, 7 places that I'm going to visit. But business on its own, they need to be very organized. They need to be very formed. That's why I mean, well, that's what I meant earlier on to say, the people who say claim that they are speaking on behalf of business, we're not doing those things that we need to do. And part of the reason has a lot to do with the fear and the lack of understanding how the world actually works, right? Our own business people are ignorant when it comes to what are the development opportunities? What's happening here next door in Mozambique? They don't know. They only know that Sasol has a pipeline coming from Mozambique and then we can go there on holiday, and that's the rest of the story. You won't find a typical South African business leader who can tell you how big is the economy of Mozambique, how big is the population, where are the business opportunities in Mozambique, and what do we need to do here as South Africans to tap into that particular market. Some know about Zimbabwe because most of them come from there, and that's all there is to it. So that's the point I'm raising around leadership development, so that our own business leaders, they must not assume that they know something because they know they are chartered accountants and they're engineers. They know how to calculate a ratio and to dig up the ground to take out a mineral and mix a chemical. You need a leadership that's very different in terms of understanding the complexity and how do we grow the economy of South Africa. We don't have those people right now. They are there in terms of talent and potential, but they need to be trained and developed. It will start with them having self-awareness that they actually don't know.
One of the biggest AU initiative that comes to mind when you're talking of the United Nations Development Goal, it is the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement, which is the largest agreement which looks at all the 54 or 5 countries in the continent with huge opportunities. And perhaps maybe this is where part of integration, at least at thought leadership point, at level, that majority of your colleagues can begin to comprehend and understand that, Africa has greater opportunities. You can't exploit opportunities if you don't know exactly what is there in a pipeline. So I suppose perhaps the bigger question or challenge for business community to grasp and comprehend in detail format the AU African Union initiative, such as the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement, because it is there. It is a template. And it has a number of programs that business communities can literally leverage on to ensure that Africa becomes, not only South Africa, but Africa becomes a developed continent. Your overall sense of how that huge AU initiative is from business point of view?
It's a great opportunity, without any doubt, to drive the economic development in the continent, not just in South Africa, because that's a point I'm trying to get to say South Africa has got a management capacity, consulting, engineering, and lots of capital, basically, that's lying around in vaults of many treasuries of the many big companies that's not actually being deployed to gain an investment hold in those particular markets. You have an opportunity, but you are not going to be able to use that opportunity if when you lift your head from your desk, the map that is sitting in your office is the map of Europe and the map of America or of the UK. Those are not your markets. They may well have been your biggest markets to date, but they are no longer where your opportunity and your potential is, right? Mm. You need to know about how big the opportunities in China are. You're not going to know it by, we sell coal and chrome and iron ore to China, or you're not even visiting China. You don't know much about what's happening in China. You don't know much about what's happening with the neighbors in China. You don't know enough about Asia because, people there don't speak English. So it starts there by tooling up with the skills, tooling up with knowledge, making our people to be global. Our business leaders, they need to be more global than they have been. They are too domestic right now. And I think that that's part of the problem, that their minds are closed because they are too focused on South Africa's small little market like this, whereas there are big, big, huge markets outside of South Africa that they need to be. But people are not going to be, you're not going to be able to say, change them. And that's why we say the academy is part of it is responsible for this, because many of the big academies, you're not going to find an African studies a specialist or experts in any one of our business schools. You go to any one of the business schools in South Africa, whether it's WITS and UCT or Pretoria, whatever the case might be, Gibbs, and they teach a lot of the European stuff, right? They teach a lot of the American stuff, as though these are the only markets that you want to be in. But the markets that you want to be in, as I just said, ASEAN countries, Cambodia, Bali, Laos, Myanmar, Philippines, Thailand, Singapore, Vietnam, big countries, 650 million people, huge economic growth. We're not doing anything there whatsoever, nothing whatsoever there. We may have maybe one or two deals with Indonesia, but if you look at the trade relationship and the trade surplus between us and that particular bloc, you'll find that it's very, very, very small. And that a lot of it must not be about we can export things, but we need to create a lot of other business opportunities with those kinds of places. That's why I'm saying the opportunity is not just with Africa, because as you talk about Africa, we're even less enthusiastic because we don't know much about what's happening out there, and people just get tired because they don't travel. You know, most people, when they say I'm going on holiday, South Africans, they're going on holiday. They're not going to Ghana, I can tell you. Find that going to Nigeria or Kenya. No. The only place they can go to on holiday in Africa is Mauritius, or Seychelles or something like that. But they're not necessarily, when they say they're going on holiday, they're going to any African country. And as a result, then you don't know what's happening in those countries. Then we complain about the Chinese. Chinese go there, they clean up in the DR, in the Great Lakes region. But that's because we don't know what's going on there. So we need to fix that knowledge and ignorance gap so that our own leaders in business here are skilled up, because we can't be complaining about cabinet ministers saying the meritocracy there. Are these people very experienced? Are they bright? When we ourselves lack the awareness that we lack that capability ourselves as business, because we don't know what's going on.
Unfortunately, you're going to have to leave it here, Alan. It is always fascinating to hear your thoughts and insights about the complexity of development. I mean, the point that you've just raised around, obviously, the ignorance. Let's do this again next week. It has been absolutely beautiful. Enjoy your day further. Shalom.